This morning is Abdulliman versus Illinois State University, case number 102926. Ms. Capitan.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, this is an appeal of an affirmance of summary judgment on the plaintiff's discrimination claim, as well as an appeal of the grant of judgment as a matter of law as to part of plaintiff's retaliation claim. And I'll address first the court's ruling that, as a matter of law, the plaintiff's complaint to the Office of Diversity and Affirmative Action was not protected activity. One thing that's important to stress about this issue is that the appellee argued that there was also no causal link between the plaintiff's complaint of discrimination and his termination or non-renewal. That's not an issue on appeal. The court ruled that there was no protected activity, and the court never reached the issue of whether there was a causal link. And although the appellant responded to that argument, it's not an issue in this case.
Was it fairly developed in the record on summary judgment?
I'm sorry, I was addressing the ruling as a motion as a matter of law in the trial. So it was an issue in summary judgment.
It was. So it was fully briefed, fully discussed. It's in the record, and we could therefore address it even though the district court did not, if it's a valid basis for affirmance.
Yes. The plaintiff need not use magic words like discrimination when it comes to addressing whether a complaint is protected. According to the Miller case, evidence from which it could reasonably be inferred that the employer knew the complaint was about discrimination is sufficient to establish protected activity. And at trial, plaintiff did present evidence that the complaints about the telecommunications search committee process were made to the Office of Diversity and Affirmative Action. He also presented evidence that the Office of Diversity and Affirmative Action was charged with making sure there was no discrimination in the hiring process at Illinois State University. He also presented evidence that Dr. Dennis knew he had complained to the Office of Diversity and Affirmative Action. However, the court ruled that there was no evidence that he had made a complaint about discrimination, that he'd been explicit about the fact that his complaint was discrimination. And that's not the standard under Miller, nor should it be, because the inquiry is really whether what the employer's intent was, whether the employer retaliated. And if the employer understood a complaint, given the context, to be about discrimination, then that should be sufficient for a finding that the employer's actions was a result of protected activity. And in holding that, also that there was not sufficient evidence that the Office of Diversity and Affirmative Action was charged with investigating complaints about discrimination, the court took defendants' evidence and contentions, accepted defendants' contentions and disregarded the plaintiff's contentions. But a jury should have been permitted to decide whether, in fact, the Office of Diversity and Affirmative Action was charged with ensuring diversity.
Well, that's not really the issue, though. Isn't the issue how much Dr. Dennis knew about the nature of the complaint?
Yes, so
he had generic knowledge that your client had made a complaint about the telecom search committee, but that's as far as it went, right?
Well, there is evidence that Dr. Dennis knew that that had been addressed by the Office of Diversity and Affirmative Action about the complaint. So
he didn't know the substance of the complaint.
He admitted to having been spoken to by the Office of Diversity and Affirmative Action about that complaint. So presumably he knew about the substance. So it's relevant that he knew the office itself and was charged with investigating diversity complaints and knew that the complaint was about discrimination, but he also knew, was talked to directly about the the specifics of the complaint as well. The court also discounted in its decision on summary judgment and barred from evidence at trial evidence related to related to similarly situated individuals and evidence related to other professors for purposes other than the similarly situated analysis. That exclusion was error for two reasons. First, because the court used an overly narrow definition of the similarly situated standard, and then also because evidence about the treatment of other professors is relevant to the issue of pretext. The court in Humphreys made clear that the similarly situated standard is a flexible standard that considers all relevant characteristics. In this case, the court held that because the plaintiff was the only associate non-tenured professor in the school, that there were no other similarly situated professors. However, in this case, Dr. Abouyemen's rank is not relevant to the issue at hand, which was his non-renewal. His non-renewal was based on likelihood that he would receive tenure. And so the relevant characteristic, if you're comparing similarly situated individuals, is whether he was tenured. And there were several individuals in the school who were non-tenured assistant professors.
But the standards are very different, aren't they, in terms of the requirements, the expectations, the length of time?
Not for tenure. So they may be different, for example, when determining salary, when determining other aspects of a professor's performance. But at issue here is Dr. Abouyemen's non-renewal. So it was fair to compare him to other non-tenured professors. In fact, the defendant compared Dr. Abouyemen to every professor in the school, including full professors, in every performance evaluation in this case.
I thought the standards were different between associate and assistant professors, that the record was pretty clear on that in terms of the scholarship expectations and the teaching expectations and the amount of time that candidates would be expected to hit their stride, for lack of a better way to put it, before they would be released from the tenure track.
Right. So the standards of performance were different, not for the purposes of tenure, however. The tenure standard and therefore the non-renewal standard made no mention of rank.
Tenure and non-renewal have the same standards, you mean?
Right. So incorporated within the non-renewal standard is an inquiry about whether the individual is likely to receive tenure.
But isn't it an increasing scale as time goes on? I'm guessing. I've never been involved in this. In fact, when I look at this, you have different people who are on the committee. They're different professors. They seem to come in with, I guess there are certain standards, but it looks like I'll call it a pretty complicated procedure, and we're trying to review it. You look at so many opinions that go in about what someone's quality is, what their writing is, their teaching, student evaluations, and what degree. This is pretty hard to get in the shoes of somebody to determine whether they did it right. Now, you say you didn't have the opportunity to put in, we'll call them comparables or similarly situated people, and the judge kept making distinctions about why someone's not similarly situated, and it does seem that there are brackets here that don't fit together and that they wouldn't be similarly situated.
Right. Well, it is a difficult inquiry when comparing professors, but it's an inquiry that the jury should have been permitted to make. The plaintiff identified sufficient similarities that a jury should have been permitted to compare the professors and determine whether, in fact, there was a material difference between them.
But the judge thought that putting, I don't want to use that cliche, comparing apples and oranges, because that's not correct, but he thought that some of these comparisons would only confuse because of these distinctions and the different standards for a jury to decide. So supposedly this committee is somewhat professionally acute and understands the differences and the nuances that go into it, and and I think the judge was trying to keep it fairly straightforward. There were, what were, there were three comparables, or whatever you want to call them, similarly situated people that they used? Is that correct?
Right.
Okay, and there were several not considered similarly situated and were not allowed to use. Is that right?
Right.
I don't remember the numbers and who was who and that they put the stuff about it. Pseudonyms and real names, and I guess there's going to be a new brief with only pseudonyms in it, I guess.
Right. Confused matters.
Well, that was confusing enough, but anyway, go ahead.
Well, the distinctions that the court pointed to between the professors we're arguing are not material. So, for example, with Dr. Zeta, the court pointed to the fact that Dr. Zeta had received a grant, and that therefore Dr. Zeta was distinguishable on that basis, had better research. But plaintiff responded that Dr. Zeta was mentored by Dr. Dennis, was first of all warned about his performance, was warned that he was unlikely to receive tenure and that he was going to be fired. He was mentored, he was helped, and Dr. Dennis helped him get the grant. And then he did improve his performance, and he was permitted to remain at the university. Dr. Abu-Yaman was not given a similar warning and was not given a similar opportunity in terms of the grant. The warning issue is relevant as well to pretext. Several professors in the university were warned, Dr. Zeta and Dr. Theta being two of them, were warned that they were in imminent danger of termination. Plaintiff was not similarly warned. And the significance of that is the genuineness of the employer's belief that Dr. Abu-Yaman was in imminent danger of being terminated, or that his performance was not sufficient to justify renewal. The court... Oh, I see that my time is up. I'll reserve the remaining time for rebuttal, if that's okay, unless you have other... Thank you.
Ms. Welsh.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Mary Welsh. I'm here on behalf of the Illinois State University. First, with regard to the judgment as a matter of law question, in fact, if you look at the evidence, the evidence makes quite clear. One professor said that in addition to deciding questions or resolving questions of discrimination, complaints of discrimination, the Office of Diversity and Affirmative Action also oversees generally the hiring process. In addition, the professor who made the complaint about the search committee, which was not plaintiff, that professor says, I went to the office because it oversees the hiring, not because I was making a complaint about discrimination. He also lists the nature of his complaints, and that has to do with there were rule violations, there were voting violations, there was interference by Director Dennis, and also that he felt that one candidate, the candidate Director Dennis favored, was not qualified because he didn't meet one of the criteria. Nothing in that testimony indicates that the person who made the complaint was in fact complaining about discrimination. And in addition, plaintiff's testimony does not state, I complained about the fact that Director Dennis was pushing a candidate, a Caucasian candidate, instead of a non-Caucasian candidate. There's nothing in the testimony that would allow any jury to infer, A, that the complaint was about discrimination, the complaint that was stated to the office was about discrimination, and or that anybody on the committee, including Director Dennis, knew the nature was about discrimination. And in fact, the result of the investigation will tell you that, because the result was that it was a do-over on the voting. So the problem was a voting procedure problem, and the solution was a voting procedure problem. So really, there's nothing in the record that indicates that it was, in fact, the diversity office was aware that it was a complaint about discrimination or that anybody on the status committee was aware that it was a complaint about discrimination. And in addition, the timing is very important here. Again, there is evidence in the record that that the decision occurred before the decision to not renew plaintiff occurred in January. Dr. Dennis stated in the summary judgment evidence, Dr. Dennis said, well, there are two things. One is a January 20th, 2006 letter to plaintiff saying, this is what's happening with your salary. And Director Dennis' affidavit there says, affidavit on summary judgment, this is 35-6 on pages 7 and 8. He says, so that decision, the decision about non-renewal, happened before the salary decision. And from the letter, we know that the salary decision happened on or before January 20th. So that means that the decision about non-renewal had to happen before January 20th. And in turn, that means that the non-renewal decision happened before the discrimination complaint about the other professor who was discharged for abysmal teaching and discharged immediately without being given the second year or just allowed to finish out the 1 year, and definitely happened before the search committee complaint. So the timing was set. We know from the summary judgment motion what the timing was on these things. Now, with regard to the evidence in particular, plaintiff challenges the district court's decision not to find certain professors similarly situated. Well, remember, you have to be similarly situated in all material respects. So certainly everybody who was tenured is not materially similar to plaintiff who was not tenured, who was seeking tenure. So all the tenured people have to go out. So, and then the question is, so you have the other tenure seekers. There were several of them. One was the one I just discussed, the other person who was fired immediately that fall, only allowed to finish out the year, not given an extra year because his teaching was so abysmal, the one who made the complaint, a discrimination complaint to the office. Another one was had been found the year before insufficient. Now, insufficient is a term of art at the university, and what the manual says, and it's in the record, right? The manual says if you're insufficient, you must be warned that you could be terminated at the next year. So that's the difference between the plaintiff and the guy who got the grant and the guy who not only got the grant but also taught four different classes, also created a new class, also had excellent service, was extremely different from plaintiff in the last year, in the 2005-2006 year. And so this is why the district court, not just because of the grant, but because of all these other differences, found the plaintiff and the person who had been found unsatisfactory, this is Theta, unsatisfactory the year before, and completely turned around. Whereas plaintiff, year after year after year, he was below average, next to last. He was in his best year, he was average. He was told that he was satisfactory. Now, if you want tenure, satisfactory isn't good enough, and you know that. And yet plaintiff decided to rest with that. And what the university decided, the evidence was that the university almost decided the year before to end his contract, but then decided it would be prudent to give him another year.
Were there three people that were similarly situated, I guess?
Well, I would say there were only three people, right? And all three of those people were let go for poor performance. There was Iota who was let go the next year. There was the guy who was let go immediately, right? And then there was the third guy, who was G, right? And they all had poor performance. This was the problem. And what the evidence showed was that everybody who had consistently poor performance got out, or had poor performance the year before tenure, out. And so either immediately or at the end. But this is one, and people who But people who were told their performance was insufficient but turned themselves around, like Theta, they got to stay.
Were there people that were, I don't know, I wouldn't call them comparables, I guess I would call them differentials, where people who did succeed in getting tenure and they showed that their qualities were all higher.
Right, exactly.
Was that part of the evidence?
That would have been. And that's why they were different. I mean, that's why they weren't comparable. Because people who did better than plaintiff got to stay, and people who did as bad or worse than plaintiff got booted. I mean, that's what the evidence showed. But so there was nobody who was, I mean, and plaintiff didn't want to have the bad comparables, if you will, the people who got booted, because it showed that the university had a practice of getting rid of people who didn't perform, just as plaintiff didn't perform, who had a history. And let's remember, plaintiff, unlike usually an assistant professor, is somebody who is just out of school, who just has his PhD. Epsilon, for example, the guy who was on the search committee, he had not even finished his PhD yet, and he was an assistant professor. Plaintiff got his PhD in 1988. Now, a guy who's had his PhD for over 15 years is going to be held to a different standard from a guy who doesn't even have his PhD yet in terms of applying the standards that apply across the board to everybody. So if you're saying what's really good scholarship for a guy who doesn't have his PhD versus really good scholarship for a guy who's had his PhD for 15 years, I mean, those are going to be two different things. And so there's a lot of, it was very hard to find, you know, to try to even imagine who could be comparable to plaintiff. But if you look at the broad category first of tenure, non-tenure, at the very least, the non-tenured people are similarly situated. But then you have to decide the similarly situated people who perform better are not similarly situated, because if they perform better, because they perform better. So they're not similarly situated to plaintiff in that extremely material respect. But the people who were similarly situated to plaintiff in all material respects, that is to say the people who were tenure track and had poor performance, every one of those in the record was gone, was let go. And so that's a difference. So as not to confuse the issue, the district court properly said, look, these people are not really similarly situated. There were three people who were let go and the one guy who got to stay. But the guy who got to stay was the guy who in the 05 letter was told he was insufficient, which means, you know, you're on notice. This is it. You have 1 year to straighten up. And he then straightened up dramatically. He did. I mean, he was told excellent service. He had had bad service. He was told great scholarship. He was told, you know, that you have good teaching. You've really improved. You've done all these courses. You've gotten new courses. This is really, I mean, the grant is one of those things. But there was a lot of other stuff that the guy who stayed was able to, you know, show that he turned himself around.
Well, apart from the factual differences between the different comparator professors, as a categorical matter, the university does treat assistant and associate professors differently.
Well, certainly,
in terms
yes.
of policy, and that's right. University policy, and it's written down, and everybody's on notice about it, right?
Right, right. I mean, that's in the manual. Certainly, you know, to go from instructor to assistant means that you are not the same. You know, to go from, you know, assistant to associate means you're not the same, that you've achieved a higher level. And the thing was, you know, plaintiff, I mean, normally when people came to the university, I believe the evidence showed that you come in as an assistant. But because plaintiff was so experienced, remember, he came in 2001, but he had already had his, at that point, he had already had his PhD for 13 years.
Right. He's basically a lateral hire.
Yes, correct.
Held to a higher standard under university policy.
What do you say?
Precisely.
What do you say to your opposing counsel's argument that while certainly there are different standards for promotion between the various academic ranks, with respect to the question of tenure, guaranteed employment, mm-hmm. there is one standard.
There is one standard, but of course it would apply differently to people with different backgrounds. For example, as I was saying earlier, if you're someone who is 5 years out of your PhD, your history of scholarly production will be less than the history of, or should be less than the history of scholarly production of somebody who's been out for 15 years. You know, you should just as we don't expect an attorney who's out of law school for 2 years to be able to issue spot, speak, you know, decide things as well as, you know, a tenure person.
How would that apply to quality of teaching?
One would expect that someone who's been teaching for 15 years would be a lot better than someone, than someone who's been teaching for only five. You know, one would expect that you would have learned over those 15 years that you know how to reach the students, you know how to engage them, you know how to, you know, pound things into their head, if you will. You know, how to get them to learn, you know, which is something, it's a skill that you learn as you develop
over
time.
Or at least that professor would not still be substandard, which is really the more relevant question here.
Right, precisely. Remember, you know, Plaintiff was doing things like he was teaching with a 10-year-old book in computer science. I mean, this is nuts. You know, he was reading from the slides that come with the book. He was doing all sorts of things that, you know, that just did not indicate that he was tenure material. And he had done this, remember, you know, from the very first year, you know, Plaintiff's evaluations were poor. They were always poor. His best evaluation was when he became average in teaching. I mean, this is not somebody that a university wants to keep on. They need to free up the spaces to find the really good people. You know, like the guy who was hired by the telecom committee, the evidence showed that the next year he was the best teacher. He was voted the best teacher by the students. And that, you know, the school director Dennis had said, you know, I'm concerned. We have the worst student evaluations in the entire university. We need to up our teaching. And, you know, and that's going to be one of my goals. He had come a year or two before the non-renewal decision here. And so this was his purpose. This is what he wanted to do. And I think, you know, what it came down to here in the telecom thing is that Plaintiff had one idea of who was the best candidate. Director Dennis had a different idea. And the plaintiff was very unhappy that his idea, you know, that his choice didn't get chosen. Again, because plaintiff felt that, you know, like the professor who made the complaint to the office, you know, that the guy didn't have his PhD when he was supposed to have his PhD according to the committee's criteria, you know, that people were voting differently. I mean, people had different ideas about how the telecom search should come out, but that doesn't mean that it's discrimination. So, if I may conclude, the question here was whether plaintiff presented sufficient admissible evidence to either survive summary judgment or to counteract the judgment as a matter of law. He didn't, and so the decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Kapteyn, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you. To briefly address the last point about the telecommunications candidate, it may indeed be the case that the candidate, Dr. Abdul-Yemen, preferred did not have a PhD at the requisite time. However, that's not why Dr. Dennis preferred the other candidate over him. There's no evidence to that effect in the record. In fact, Dr. Dennis was unable to articulate why he favored the Caucasian candidate over this candidate. And in fact, he did acknowledge that the candidate had excellent teaching as well as the candidate that he preferred, as far as they could tell from their resumes and their applications. With respect to Dr. Zeta's performance, Appellee pointed out that Dr. Zeta's performance improved significantly. If you look at the performance evaluation of Dr. Zeta that last year, which is on page 15 of the supplemental appendix, and it's the same year that Dr. Abdul-Yemen was not renewed, his performance was ranked as effective, which is the lowest category, and which is lower than where Dr. Abdul-Yemen was ranked. His scholarly productivity, which is the grant is relevant to that, was ranked as meritorious, and that's the same category that Dr. Abdul-Yemen was ranked in. Dr. Abdul-Yemen that year Only five professors performed better than him in both teaching and scholarship, which are the two most important categories according to the university. So it's simply not the case that the record is clear as a matter of law that Dr. Theda's performance was that much better, such that he should have been renewed, whereas Dr. Abdelyaman was not.
Do many people get tenure here?
At Illinois State University?
Well, I don't know how the school is divided up, but is tenure hard to get? Do very few make it?
There are a few examples in the record of professors not making it. However, two of those professors were able to continue employment up until the tenure decision itself.
Yeah.
And it's unusual. There's no other example in the record other than plaintiff of somebody being non-renewed right before they were permitted to apply for tenure. And the significance of that is that when the tenure decision is made, it goes to a higher level in the university. It's not under the control of the SFSC. So if plaintiff had been permitted to apply for...
The whole school or higher, okay.
Right.
Well, I read somewhere in there that it's better to get non-renewal than non-tenure if you're looking at a job somewhere else. I don't know whether that has any bearing or not. But
if you're able to get a job somewhere else, maybe that's the case, but it's not good for a professor to be fired.
He did get a job somewhere else, I guess. I guess he went back to Saudi Arabia.
Right. Okay.
Your time is up, counsel. Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.